The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
People of Earth, welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia Online. My name is Jason Freeman. I'm a producer and editor here in the Free Library's author events office, and I'm pleased to be here to introduce tonight's guest, Brian Green. Referred to by the Washington Post as the single best explainer of abstruse science in the world today, Brian Green is a professor of physics and mathematics at Columbia University. His New York Times best-selling books include The Fabric of the Cosmos, The Hidden Reality, and The Elegant Universe, which later served as the basis of two Peabody and Emmy Award-winning NOVA series. Renowned for his watershed discoveries in superstring theory, Green is the co-founder of the World Science Festival, the director of Columbia University's Center for Theoretical Physics, and according to my research, he's just a very popular, ubiquitous cultural figure to boot. He is here tonight with his new book, Until the End of Time, Mind, Matter, and Our Search for Meaning in an Evolving Universe. Not merely an exploration of the cosmos, it is a reflection about our place within the ever-expanding vastness of the universe. In a very British-sounding review, the book was praised by the Sunday Times of London as a cracking read. The origins of matter, life, and consciousness, and their grisly fate are laid out here with elegant clarity. If you want to know how everything got here and where it's going, read this book. Tonight's author will be in conversation with Dennis Overby, science reporter for the New York Times and author of the books Lonely Hearts of the Cosmos and Einstein in Love. Brian, Dennis, thank you both so much for being here, and take it away.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jason. I'm very happy to be here, and I have to say that I'm very honored to be share the stage with Brian Green. My admiration and jealousy of Brian Green is unbounded. I've known him for some 20 years, and we live a few blocks apart in New York. When I first came to New York to join the Times, he was this hotshot young string theorist who wrote an improbably literate, entertaining, and best-selling book, The Elegant Universe, about string theory. Who knew that string theory would be a best-selling subject? I watched him and his wife, Tracy Day, start up the World Science Festival, a week-long celebration of science and the arts that happens every year on my birthday. And now this. So I have to ask. So Brian, you wrote this book about the end of the world, the end of the universe, and you published it in February of 2020. In fact, the world didn't end, but it came to a stop. How did that feel? What kind of experience did that feel?
Well, first, thank you, Dennis, so much for those kind words. I have equal admiration for you, so thank you very much. But you're absolutely right. The book did come out at a curious moment, you know, just a few weeks before the world as we knew it changed. And there was for me personally, a kind of eerie synchrony between the topic of the book and the way the world proceeded. It's interesting because when I was writing the book, of course, I assumed the world would be as it always had been. So I was writing as if the audience was in the frame of mind, not that there's a singular frame of mind for all people on planet Earth, but the general sense of being a human on this planet, I didn't think it was going to radically change. For me, though, the change in a sense, well, look, this has been a tumultuous, tragic time for many of us. The experience of the last year has only deepened my conviction that understanding our place in the cosmic order and recognizing the fragility of life can deeply enhance our experience for the fleeting moment that we are here. So I would say that the last year has really been a confirmation of the ideas that I was describing in the book.
And you and your family are all fine. You weathered it, the storm okay, I assume.
You kind of. I mean, certainly, you know, my wife, Tracy, who you mentioned, is fine, and my kids are fine. We took my mom out of Manhattan, my elderly mom, 92 years old, up here where I am now in the Catskill Mountains, upstate New York. She went to an eye doctor in the city just for one visit, and 8 days later, she had died. She died of the virus.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so it's been a rough ride for many of us, for all of us, in one way or another. But yeah, we were directly touched, as of course many families have been.
So, stepping back, so everything that lives dies. I think it's the first line. In the fullness of time, all that lives will die. This doesn't necessarily seem like maybe a killer first line. What compelled you to write this book, and how long did it take you to write it? I mean, there's an enormous amount of learning packed into these pages, and every one of these yellow tabs is like things I wanted to quote when I reviewed the book.
Well, it's an interesting question, which makes me reflect back for a half a second on a similar question that I remember asking my dad when I was a little kid. He wrote an off-Broadway musical, and it didn't get great reviews for various reasons. And so he was distraught over this. And I said to him, you know, how long did it take you to write this? And his response to me was, it took me my entire life. And I guess in some sense, that's my answer to your question. Of course, I sat down to start writing this book at a particular moment, you know, in the last couple of years, I guess it was probably three years ago. But the ideas that I was setting down are ones that have been percolating either in the forefront or in the back of my mind for many decades. So in some sense, I felt like it was a book that was gestating for a very, very long period of time. And what drove me to write it, well, I always knew that I wanted to write this book. It was inspired, as I describe in the book itself, by something I read, a book I read back, 30 years ago, a book called The Denial of Death by Ernest Becker. Not that many people know of that book now. I don't know why. It won the Pulitzer Prize back in the 70s, but you know, these things, that's what happens. And Becker in that book described how our singular recognition among all species, our singular understanding of our own mortality, has a deep impact on the decisions we make and the things we care about and the goals that we set for ourselves and the way we live our day-to-day lives. And I saw that recognition parallel to our own understanding that the universe in some sense dies, that the universe also has a beginning, we believe, and a childhood and an adolescence and an old age, and it ultimately suffers its own kind of mortal demise in the far future. And the interplay between the individual's recognition that they're going to die and the physicist, astronomer's recognition that the universe is going to die, that struck me as a deep interconnection between us and the cosmos, which only amplifies our growing recognition of how we are connected in some way to all that there is. And that really was what drove me to start to set these ideas to paper.
But you weave this through religion and art and biology and philosophy. I mean, have you been assembling all this material, all your life, right? I sort of imagined you doing some like fantastic cram course or volunteering to teach a class on it at Columbia or something, right? Because understand that how professors learn things, they teach a class. But
I say it's a little of both, really. I mean, it's not as though I've been taking notes for decades, but I have been deeply interested in so many of the ideas that I described there. I mean, way back when I was in college, you know, I was doing the standard physics curriculum as an undergraduate, a lot of math thrown in, but I was always going to the religion courses, and I wasn't taking them for credit. For the most part, I was just sitting in on them because I found the topics so interesting, so fascinating. And I continued to do that when I was a young faculty member at Cornell in the 1990s. You know, I'd be teaching my physics classes, but I, every semester, would sit in on either a philosophy class or a religion class, quietly in the back, just absorbing ideas that I found resonant with the ideas that I was interested in physics, even though, of course, the technical mathematical work that we undertake doesn't make use of any of these ideas. But the motivation for studying unification, the motivation for trying to understand quantum mechanics and general relativity, for me, the motivation is ultimately a similar analogous motivation for much of what drives philosophers and theologians. And so I found a kind of consonance between the journeys that I enjoyed spending time in.
You think you're typical in this, or you're maybe a little bit out of the ordinary? I would guess. Do you think of yourself as I was going to ask you if you thought of yourself as a spiritual guy. Well, I remember that.
Yeah, I mean,
this is first World Science Festival. I remember you going up to this church in Harlem and said that you'd love to be reincarnated as a Baptist preacher. You are like a nice Jewish boy who grew up in New York, and I was sort of wondering just how all this played out in your life.
That's interesting. I do remember that event at the Abyssinian Baptist Church, a program on music and the brain, as I recall. And I was introducing Oliver Sacks, who was the main event. But I do recall standing at that podium and feeling the energy of the Baptist choir behind me. And it definitely felt like an enjoyable and familiar place. And I do consider myself spiritual. I don't consider myself to be one who follows the rituals of any specific world religion. As you mentioned, you know, I'm definitely born and raised Jewish, but my interest in the spiritual side of things is really an interest in introspection. And much of what we do as physicists, of course, is study the external world. And in our papers, we do all we can to excise anything to do with the individual, anything right. to do with the human, right? We're looking for the laws that transcend all the vagaries of individual perception and observation. And that is a valuable and valiant undertaking, but there's more to life beyond that. And the part that leaves out, which is the part that William James really put his finger on in Varieties of Religious Experience that he wrote back in 1902, what that really leaves out is all of the wonder and beauty and mystery of the inner journey and the inner experience of this external world. So that inner journey is really what captures my interest and my attention, and therefore drives me to spend some time thinking about and learning about what other thinkers and other seekers throughout the ages have done to understand their own reactions, their own self-reflective ability, their own deeply subjective response to the world, exactly the stuff that we ignore and do our best to excise as physicists.
Right, when you write all those papers and with passive sentences.
Yeah. I mean, you put out a paper where you actually inject something on a more personal front, the odds are the referee is going to flag it and ask you to do something about it, which is kind of sad, right? Because if you go back to the early papers of quantum mechanics, the double slit experiment, that paper, you know, Davison and Germer described the accident in the laboratory at Bell Labs where they turned up the intensity of the electron beam too high, causing the evacuated chamber to explode, and it tarnished the sample, and they cleaned the sample, thereby changing it. And that sets them up for this fortuitous discovery at the heart of quantum mechanics. Today, if you wrote that paper, you wouldn't admit to the accident. You would just describe it as some, you know, objective approach that you took that led to this result. But the human story from the 1927 paper is thoroughly exciting and deeply interesting to read. And it's kind of sad that we don't do that anymore.
Yeah. See, on the book, you talk, so we're talking about religion. You talk about religion in the book and whether it's an adaptive development or not. You talked about a little bit about that.
Yeah, and it's a highly controversial subject, but I think it's a deeply interesting one that is an offshoot in some sense of evolutionary psychology, which is this notion that, sure, we're all familiar and any thinking person recognizes that evolution by natural selection has deeply impacted and shaped our biological form, our physical form, right? I mean, that is something that has been so deeply established in the scientific record that anybody who challenges that is really not seeing clearly. But an interesting parallel question is, beyond the physical, what about our behaviors and the things that we have a tendency or a predilection to pursue? Might those also have an evolutionary basis? And researchers over decades have established that the answer to that question, at least in certain cases, is yes, right? I mean, the reason why we all enjoy sweets and fats is because our forebears in the ancestral environment, those who had this inclination to eat those foodstuffs, are the ones that were hardy when times turned lean and they survived and passed on that behavioral predilection to their descendants. Could it be the case that religion might be another behavioral tendency that evolution has selected for? And one of the ideas along this line from Emil Durkheim and David Sloan Wilson is that religion may have been the glue that bound together our ancestors into powerful groups, right? Groups that did not just have, you know, brothers and sisters, mothers and fathers, that went beyond those who were related to you. That you can explain with evolution because we share genes with those individuals. Right. How do you get individuals that don't share any genes to want to sacrifice for each other, to protect each other, to work together as a whole? And a common belief, a common religious belief may have been the answer to that question. That may have been what bound us into groups that made us more formidable opponents in the battles that took place in our hunter-gatherer past. So maybe those of our forebears who had belief are the ones that prevailed, passing on a genetic tendency to have belief that then spread widely across planet Earth. That's one idea.
But so sociobiology is kind of controversial, though, right? Because it has been attacked because kind of a sort of just so stories and, you know, well, we're xenophobic because our genes make us xenophobic, you know, you can go on and on, you know.
Yeah.
No, you have to be male roles, you know, rape and war, they're all like in our genes. And so that's how we do it. So
you have to be deeply skeptical of any of these pronouncements. And, you know, you have to be rigorous in your thinking and recognize that you want the evidence and the argument for the naturally selected behavior that you're describing to be as strong as the naturally selected explanation for why we have an opposable thumb, right? You really want these arguments to be tight. And the reason they're controversial is they're not tight yet today. Now, the proponents often argue that they are tighter than you might think, but the mere fact that you've got deep thinking evolutionary biologists who challenge some of these ideas suggests at least that it's deeply still in the realm of controversy. I mean, there are other evolutionary explanations too. I don't want to leave it just at the David Sloan Wilson group selection type of idea. There's also a notion that goes right back to the book I mentioned at the outset, The Denial of Death. The proponents of the school of thought that Ernest Becker gave rise to, it's called terror management theory, pursued by a number of social psychologists, they suggest that religion allowed our forebears simply to have the ability to go on and to pursue all that was necessary for their own survival in the face of their growing recognition of their own mortality. And the language that they use is quite evocative. They describe how without religion, our forebears may have been reduced to quivering piles of protoplasm on the ancestral plane, unable thereby to do all that was necessary to prevail and survive. I mean, Stephen Jay Gould famously said that all religions begin with an awareness of death. And this is an outgrowth of that recognition that since religion often promises that death is not the end, that may have been what we needed to buck up our forebears. Again, another potential evolutionary explanation for religion.
Maybe we should just briefly go through the kind of the gloomy picture you have for the universe. It is gloomy. I mean, it's like, well, something happens and then it just kind of fades off and nothing, you know.
I'm more than happy to go through it, but I would say that I don't summarize it as a gloomy picture. Of course, I understand precisely what you're talking about. And those who are listening by the end of our discussion may perhaps come to a description similar to yours. They may view it as gloomy, but I view it as an understanding that focuses the lens of value and purpose so that the light shines on that part of the cosmological terrain that offers the greatest chance to have a sense of meaning and value and purpose. As opposed to lacking this understanding, I think our forebears and many people on this planet tend to look to the future. It's always future oriented. That's where value comes from. It's legacy, it's impact. But when you think about the so-called gloomy picture that I'm about to summarize, it casts that view of reality in a very different light. But you're right. So we're now 13 billion years from the Big Bang. That cosmological story has been told many times, so I won't go through that. But as you turn toward the future, entropy, second law of thermodynamics, in rough language, the decay and withering away of structure, that will gain the upper hand. So, you know, the sun itself has got another 5 billion years until it turns into a dead star. The Earth, well, it's hard to know, but it could die when the sun swells about 5 billion years from now, or it may spiral in to the dead sun, losing energy from gravitational radiation. That could be about 10 to the 20 years from now. By about 10 to the 30 years, most stars have fallen into their galaxy's black hole. The stars are dead by that point, but they still exist. They will fall into their galaxy's black hole. By 10 to the 38 years or so, we suspect that protons, the heart of all matter, all complex matter, will disintegrate into a spray of particles, so all complex matter falls apart. By 10 to the 50 years from now, you can argue that any thinking structure that might still exist, one more thought and it will burn up. It'll fry in the entropic waste created by the very process of thought itself. The universe won't be able to absorb the
preacher right now.
What's that?
I said I'm seeing the Baptist preacher right now.
Yeah, that's right. It comes out, you know, even without the choir behind me. You know, and then you know, between I use this Empire State Building analogy that I haven't mentioned here, but between 10 to the 68 and 10 to the 100 years from now, black holes disintegrate into a spray of particles. So roughly speaking, by about 10 to the 100 years from now, everything has fallen apart into particles that waft through the cosmos. So yeah, you can call that gloomy because everything that we know about, everything we care about disintegrates and goes away. But on the other hand, it also establishes how utterly spectacular it is that we have this moment, this cosmological epoch, when the conditions are right, at least on this planet, for collections of particles to come together into groups that can think and feel and have conversations like we're having right now and argue and debate and do awful things, but do some spectacularly wonderful things. How wondrous is it that the universe allows for such structures to form?
So we're here for the party.
We're here for the party, man. We just got here. And we're going to hopefully not overstay our welcome.
But there are this is sort of, you know, this is modern cosmology as we know it, but there could be all kinds of escape hatches in the future. Right? I would wonder if you, for example.
Absolutely. Yeah. So what I described is certainly informed by one particular cosmological scenario that you are deeply familiar with, and perhaps many of those who are listening to us are as well. It's called the inflationary theory, the inflationary paradigm, which has done a spectacular job of explaining data from the early universe, and thereby has convinced many that it is a viable way of thinking about the origin and the evolution of the universe until today. And what I'm doing is I'm taking that idea and I'm pivoting with it and using it to describe the far future. Now, if that idea turns out to be wrong or needs to be modified, yeah, there are alternate things that could happen in the far future. The universe could expand for a while. I'm assuming it'll expand forever, but it could expand for a while, reach a maximum size, and maybe collapse back in on itself, a kind of reverse of the Big Bang or a big crunch. Are there, in a more exotic way, the universe as we know it could end more quickly if the Higgs field, which people may be familiar with, was posited back in the 60s and finally discovered on July 4th of 2012, the announcement happened. If the value of this field that we believe permeates all of space, if it should suddenly change, then the properties of matter would suddenly change, likely meaning the end again of everything that we know about. And therefore, that particular escape hatch results in an earlier demise than the one that I was describing. So it's very hard to have a scenario, though, where the universe as we know it persists indefinitely. And that, I think, is the overarching message of any of these cosmological theories.
I should ask you what, if you have hope for any of them, or you're a string theorist. How is string theory doing these days?
It's a good question, and I can't give you a one word answer. Not that you were looking for a one word answer. So the way I look at it is, when I was a graduate student back in the 1980s, there were certain things that we imagined we might have figured out in, say, my lifetime. Not a bad measure of time to talk about. And there's certain things that nobody really envisioned that we would figure out. And on each of those counts, we were wrong. And I think that gives an interesting perspective on where we stand with string theory. So on the things that we never thought we'd figure out, I don't think anyone thought we'd have an exact formulation of string theory. And yet in the past decade or two, we have achieved that, at least in certain circumstances. I don't think anybody thought that we would have an understanding of string theory that would give us the kinds of insights into black holes that are now happening at a rapid pace. And there's great promise for what's happening there. I don't think anybody thought we'd have even an ability to speak about the ingredients making up the space-time fabric. And yet string theory has given us that vocabulary and a way into that question that I don't think anybody thought would happen by this point. However, I do think that most of us thought we'd have some experimental evidence in support of these ideas by today, 40 years later. And that certainly has not happened. The Large Hadron Collider that we hoped would reveal the so-called supersymmetric particles that are not necessarily required by string theory, but most people thought that this would be the first circumstantial evidence in support of the theory. They have not been found. Now, they could still be found, but the window of opportunity has closed substantially. And I think many people are quite pessimistic that we will find those particles, say, at the Large Hadron Collider. So I would say on the theoretical front, we're further along than I would have thought back in the 80s. But on the observational experimental front, we're not as far as long along as I would have hoped or thought. And many people, I think, share that perspective.
So there was a result a few weeks ago that people got very excited. This G-2 muon measurement, which provides maybe a crack of light cracking the standard model. How do you think about that?
Well, I think it's extremely exciting for exactly the reason that you're indicating. People like to say that in some sense, you know, we have been the victim of our own success. The so-called standard model of particle physics has done an incredibly good job at describing almost all experimental data. And so the opportunity to go beyond it with a new theory that can patch up its holes or fix up its problems, we haven't really faced holes or problems. So having finally an experiment, this G minus two experiment, having to do with the magnetic properties of muons, having a mismatch, or I should say a potential mismatch between the theoretical ideas and the observations. Well, if it holds up, that would be a great opportunity for us to say, okay, how do we fix this problem? And that then may indicate one or another theoretical direction as being the best one, the one that's singled out by the data. And that hasn't happened. That procedure of data driving the theory hasn't happened for a long time. So again, though, it does rely on an assumption that this result will stand up.
So where do you see hope that there might be data driving the theory?
Yeah, two things naturally come to mind. Certainly, gravitational waves, at least in principle, by offering us a new way of observing the universe, I can imagine that subtle effects of the melding of quantum mechanics and gravity, which is what string theory and quantum gravity more generally tries to do, I can imagine a possibility where we'll be able to draw a link between some subtle feature of quantum gravity and this new approach to observing the universe with incredible precision that comes from gravitational wave physics. That's one possibility. The other possibility is more straightforward. I mean, maybe the next machine. And when will that machine be built? One that's even more powerful than the Large Hadron Collider. It may happen in China. There's at least a good possibility of that. And when you examine the universe with ever higher energy scales, you're examining it on ever smaller distance scales. And there is at least a hope that you'll begin to see new physics that we've never seen before and that does not fit in to the standard model of particle physics, and thereby does what we hope the G minus two anomaly might do, but more generally, what we hope data does, which is shine a light on a direction, as opposed to just leave it up to the mathematics, which is all that we've been doing for the past 20 or 30 years.
Right. What about the cosmic microwave background? I actually expected you to mention that.
Yeah, I mean, it's unclear to me whether we have wrung as much insight as possible from the cosmic microwave background or not. So I'm a general optimist. So I would definitely put that in there as a possibility. I mean, look, I wrote papers some years ago with colleagues where we indicated subtle features of the temperature variations, the anisotropies of microwave background radiation that could reflect aspects of string theory, or generally aspects of any theory that has a shortest possible length scale. That's kind of a iconic quality of theories that try to understand space and time and quantum mechanics all in one go. And there was a paper at one point which suggested maybe these subtle temperature variations had been found, but that didn't stand up to the test of time, unfortunately. And so, yes, it's conceivable that this heat left over from the Big Bang may show residual imprints of quantum physics as it played out in the earliest moments of the universe. And today, by examining that background radiation, maybe we can see those imprints. It's possible. I wouldn't say that I'm overly optimistic about that possibility, but yes, it's definitely in there as a possibility.
All right, I got to change the subject a little bit. So World Science Festival, right? Starting in 2008, tremendous success. I mean, sold out, and it's just become a general cultural institution. And it seems to me there's a lot of the TED Talks are like all over the place. the internet is full of, full of YouTube animations of complicated physics and so forth. The whole science has kind of emerged as almost as kind of a, like a sort of a highbrow entertainment in a way. And you've helped create this. There's enormous interest. People don't know how interested they are in this stuff until they actually hear it well done and then like them. But so you would think that science literacy is just growing in the world. But in the last year, when science came home to roost in the worst health crisis I ever hoped to experience, millions of people rejected the advice of science in the medical establishment. They didn't wear masks, they didn't social distance, that a lot of them won't get shots. I think it was Daniel Moynihan that said, everyone is entitled to their own opinion, but they're not entitled to their own facts. That's a famous one. But it seems to me, and that science, if science is about anything, it's like it's kind of finding out the facts about the world as a way of interrogating nature. But it seems lately more and more people have decided that they are entitled to their own facts. Not just about the pandemic, but who won the election and so forth, and whether climate, you can. So what science failed somehow?
Yeah. So it's a good question, and one I've given a good deal of thought to. And at first blush, you might think that the willingness of so many people to turn from the manifest truths that science reveals suggests that you and I and everybody else of our ilk who tries to get science out there to the wider world, that somehow we failed, that somehow we've not done our job. And I think that's the wrong way of thinking about the problem, because that suggests that those who turn from science are doing so because they are bringing to bear some kind of evaluation of what science has provided and have come to a determination that it is not the set of facts and beliefs that they deem to be the ones most relevant to the world. But of course, that's not the case. Most individuals that turn from science are not doing so through a kind of judge and jury model of the world. They're turning from science because they belong to a group, and that group has rejected science. And so their evaluation has nothing to do with how good we've done in terms of getting science out there and explaining the ideas and making it interesting and exciting. And therefore, that's not the solution to the problem either. It's not better science education. It's not better popularizations of science. Rather, it's really systematically looking at why groups of individuals in our country and around the world are so disgruntled and so feeling that they've gotten the short end of the stick and so anti anything that's part of the hierarchy that they believe has oppressed them. And listening carefully to those grievances and trying to structure our society in a way that isn't, say, driven by each and every grievance about the world, but tries to make the world a more inclusive, a more loving place than it is today, I think that's ultimately where the solution will be found. And so to me, it's identity politics as opposed to anything to do with science itself.
I can't help commenting that maybe identity politics are another one of these Darwinian adaptations that we're talking about.
It could well be. And if that way of framing it helps the wider world address the issues, that would be spectacular. But in the end of the day, it's a matter of us recognizing that there's groups of individuals in this world whose view of their place is so disheartening to them and the rest of the group that they're willing to turn away from things that the rest of us see as manifest truth.
So maybe we should go to questions.
Sure.
If matter energy cannot be created or lost, how can the universe die? Will this universe die, or the matter energy of the universe change as the universe evolves?
Yeah, so the whole question of the conservation of energy on cosmological scales is actually much more subtle than the one that we learn in school. But that's actually not the key to this answer. But let me just quickly mention, we're used to the statement that we learn in school that there's overall conservation of energy. And that's certainly true in a laboratory experiment. When you try to apply those ideas in cosmological scales, there are deep subtleties. So don't assume that that's necessarily the case. But be that as it may, that's not the answer that I want to give to the question. The answer I want to give is this. The death of the universe need not be thought of as the loss of energy. Rather, I just got a Skype call that I just had to reject. the death of the universe instead is the dissipation of structure, of organized matter. And that's the rise of entropy. And so when I imagine 10 to the 100 years from now and think about that in some sense as the death of the universe, even though more exotic things can happen over even longer time scales, put that to the side, I'm not imagining that the universe has lost its energy. I'm imagining that the universe has lost its structure, that stars have dissipated, that planets have dissipated into particles, that particle conglomerates of any sort have fallen apart so that all that's left are particles wafting through the void. And so that's the signal that the universe as we know it is gone, because the universe as we know it has its qualities only because there are organized collections of matter called stars and planets and people and everything else that we hold dear.
And these particles are very, very far apart.
At that point, absolutely. Yes.
I've heard it said that the time would just stop then too, because you don't really have any way of measuring time if there's no change, which might be a kind of hard concept to swallow, but
yep,
we haven't talked about time.
Yeah, I mean, people do talk that way, that if you think about time as that which allows change to take place, and if the universe reaches a state in which there's effectively no change on large scales, it's just particles wafting through the void, there is a sense in which there's no conception of time. But on a local scale, there still would be. I mean, particles are moving from one location to another. So there is change in that more microscopic sense. But in any macroscopic sense, yes, we will hit durations through which no change occurs. And therefore, in some macroscopic sense, one would say that time has stopped.
Could there be random fluctuations in these particles that would might actually eventually lead to another big bang?
Yeah.
Wait so, long enough?
Absolutely. So that's what I, in some sense, was referring to that and other exotic things that can happen over even longer timescales. I mean, again, 10 to the 100 years is so enormous a duration that none of us has any intuition for what that really means, right? We understand hours and days and centuries, millennia, perhaps. We can think back to, you know, the time of the first written documents, you know, a handful of thousands of years ago. But we're talking about durations that dwarf even the time back to the Big Bang. You know, that's 10 to the 10 years. We're talking 10 to the 100 years. But if you allow the math to go even further, then exactly what you're saying can take place over longer timescales. Particles that are wafting through the void can on occasion hit each other and stick together, and then find another particle and stick with that particle. And over a sufficiently long period of time, new structures can form out of that kind of process. And those structures could be even human brains. This is the so-called Boltzmann brain issue. You could have brains floating in the void. But on even rarer occasions, the conditions necessary to spark a new Big Bang might arise. And therefore, if you wait sufficiently long, then you can imagine things beginning again with some kind of primordial phase in which the universe undergoes a rapid swelling from a dense energetic core that is what you would need to spark that new beginning. So yes, it could start again.
Do you think there are other universes that have undergone the same entropic scenario you described, or conversely, have the potential to continually expand rather than disintegrate into terminal oblivion?
Yeah, it's a tricky question. And part of the answer depends on, I think, what the questioner was supposing, that there are other universes, that there is a multiverse. And if you allow for the possibility of other universes, which is a separate conversation, but it does naturally emerge from this inflationary scenario, so it's not as far-fetched to the ear as it might at first sound. But if there are multiple universes, then you can argue fairly convincingly that among those universes, there are some that thwart this drive toward ever greater disorder, simply because this idea of the second law of thermodynamics and the increase of entropy, it's not an ironclad law. It's a statistical law. It's a statement that it's overwhelmingly likely and hugely overwhelmingly likely that entropy will increase, that disorder will increase, but that doesn't mean that it has to increase. And with enough other universes out there, you can argue convincingly that some will beat the statistical odds. And in those universes, structures will continue to persist for arbitrarily long periods of time. Now, are we in one of those universes? It's possible. It's just that the odds against it are so stupendously large that it's almost ridiculous to hope that we are in one of those universes. But in the whole multiverse, will some universes beat the odds and stick around for arbitrarily long periods of time? Yes.
But we won't be there.
We will not be there.
Let's see. Has the pandemic put a stop to any important research that was happening beforehand?
Yeah, I have no doubt. You can't imagine that when there's an exodus of faculty from universities and researchers from think tank places where great research is taking place, that things are going to be deeply affected. What I've been heartened by, though, is how scientists have adapted. Scientists have found ways of gathering together, like many of us have in the digital realm, and have found ways of decreasing the density of researchers in certain research facilities, and thereby being able to go back into the laboratory at a lower rate of progress and continue pushing the boundaries of understanding. So the answer is absolutely yes, but perhaps less than you might have thought that the pandemic would have impacted cutting edge research.
Here's one I like. Okay. This guy identifies himself as a physics graduate student. He says, what is your favorite part of the book writing process?
Favorite part of the book writing process? Well, it's nice to be done, right? That's certainly a good moment. But I have to say, look, I spend part of my time doing physics research and part of my time writing and among other activities. And each has its joys and each has its hardships. I mean, you know, you're doing physics research and the great moments are when the equations fall together and you have some insight, but most of the time you're slogging away and it's not quite working. Similarly in the writing process, I mean, Dennis, I don't know what your process is, but I try to write 3 pages a day. And then I go back the next day, and as much as I try to resist rewriting those 3 pages, I do rewrite them. And so that process of pushing forward and going back is something that is the rhythm that I'm within. But I have to say, there are many times in that process where I say to myself, I can't imagine doing anything else right now. I am so enjoying thinking about these ideas and writing them down and trying to get them across in a way that feels interesting and exciting, that I find the process itself completely compelling. But then the next day, when you reread those pages that you thought were wonderful, and you're like, oh man, that wasn't good at all. You know, you have your ups, you have your downs.
Yeah, yeah. I've written many sentences like that that died the next day.
Yeah.
Building on an earlier question, given the unimaginable amount of time that will pass to get to 10 to the 100th in years in the future, isn't it highly unlikely we have enough data to predict that far out?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. Okay. And it does take a certain amount of, well, what we would call chutzpah to to take our understanding of the universe that has done a great job at explaining from the Big Bang until today, 13.8 billion years, and assuming that the insights that we've had to develop to get that explanation are the very insights that will continue to guide things into the far future. You're absolutely right, questioner. It could be the case that there are big surprises happening down the road that will completely transform our understanding. The problem is we can't say anything about those surprises. And it's a very interesting exercise, therefore, to take the conservative perspective that what we've figured out really are the laws. I mean, again, where does that confidence come from? You mentioned G minus two for the muon, right? But G minus two for the electron, this magnetic property of electron, we can use mathematics, our current theories, to predict that value to 10 decimal places after the decimal point, and digit by digit by digit, our theoretical calculations agree with the observational numbers. So when you have theories that are able to do that and able to, say, predict the existence of black holes, confirmed, are able to predict the expansion of the universe, confirmed, be able to predict the existence, say, of the Higgs particle in the Higgs field, confirmed. When you have this collection of mathematical insights that one after the other, prediction of gravitational waves, confirmed. When you have all this happening, it gives you a sense of confidence that maybe we do have the fundamental ideas, and therefore, let's see what these ideas tell us about our fate. Now, is that an ironclad argument? No. But is it a worthwhile and interesting exercise to see what the current understanding tells us about the future? I think it is deeply interesting.
Well, it's only any one of those places you could find a little loose thread hanging out there.
Yeah, absolutely.
What potential do you see for artificial intelligence or artificially intelligent agents to assist physicists with theoretical and experimental research?
Well, it's really already happening. Maybe not in my line of physics yet, but certainly, as you may have, the questioner may have read, there's been great insight into a biology, chemistry question, the protein folding problem. So, you know, Demis Hassabis, his team at DeepMind, is that the name of the company? I think it is.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think he's the last person I had lunch with in person before the pandemic hit. We had lunch in London, and he was describing the work that subsequently they published, where this age-old question in biology of how these long chains of amino acids, how do they fold in on themselves, which is vital to understand the functioning of a given protein. They've not solved it per se, but they've made incredible headway using the ideas that they have developed in trying to push the frontiers of artificial intelligence. They're the same group that had the Go program that was able to be, you know, the masters of that game with just a few hours of training on large data sets. So any problem that has large data sets where spotting patterns and learning from those patterns is the way forward is going to benefit from artificial intelligence. And ultimately, what is physics? Physics is about looking at the data of the cosmos or the particulate realm and finding the patterns and finding the mathematics that encapsulates those patterns and trying to push forward with that mathematical insight. So I have little doubt that artificial intelligence will continue and will only play an ever larger role as we go forward.
Why isn't there any evidence for life in the universe apart from our planet? Wouldn't it be rational to suspect life to be as ubiquitous in the universe as on Earth?
Well, again, it's a tough question, but there are certainly many ways of thinking about that question. I mean, think about planet Earth for a moment. It may have been a chance event that allowed life on this planet to elevate itself from the form that it had for billions of years to a form called intelligent life, debatable, but intelligent life that can reach out and actually potentially make contact with other life in the cosmos, right? So if a meteor hadn't slammed down, asteroid hadn't slammed down on this planet 65 million years ago, it could still be that the dinosaurs were walking around. So wiping out the dinosaurs made room for some warm-blooded mammals that ultimately gave rise to us, right? But without that, we may not be listening to the cosmos for other life, nor would we be doing things that other life on other distant worlds would be able to sense. So if on other planets, there is life, maybe it is ubiquitous. If it's not reaching out, then it's very hard to detect. Now, that's not saying we can't detect it, right? The James Webb Space Telescope is going to be examining the atmospheres of distant planets looking for biomarkers. Now, will those markers establish, if they're found, will they establish that there's life on those planets? No, but it will be interesting circumstantial evidence in that direction. So our view on this question may change radically in the next decades as we examine the universe with greater precision. But, you know, the argument that we haven't been contacted or visited as an argument that there isn't other life out there in the cosmos is woefully weak, because there are many explanations for why that perhaps has not happened.
There was a question that I'm asking what advice you had for a young physicist.
Well, that's a great question.
That's a good question anyway.
Yep. Yeah, you know, and my advice is actually quite concrete. So I think it's important for aspiring young scientists and physicists to get excited about what's happening at the forefront of thought, forefront of research, and they can do that by reading Dennis's articles, by reading books. As Dennis mentioned, there's all sorts of material online where people are talking about their work and so forth. So there's a lot of resource out there. But what I consider to be even more vital is that that inspiration is backed up by young students learning the basics inside out. I can't tell you how many students have, say, come to an advanced class of mine and they want to learn about string theory or general relativity. And I say, but like, have you taken physics one? You know, do you know calculus? And no, I don't like math. I just want to get to the big forefront ideas. And sure, you can do that if you just want to culturally immerse yourself in science. But if you want to be a physicist, you've got to learn all of the basics: classical mechanics, quantum mechanics, statistical mechanics, thermodynamics, quantum field theory, the general theory of relativity. You got to back it up with calculus 1, 2, 3, and 4, linear algebra, topology, perhaps, differential geometry, maybe algebraic geometry. You have to really immerse yourself in all that's known if you hope to ultimately push the frontiers of what's not known. So that's really my advice.
What do you think of Dirac's idea that gravity was stronger in earlier times?
Well, the idea that forces change their strength based upon the energy scale of the cosmos, which does change in time, is a very fruitful idea that has allowed us to understand the strong nuclear force, the weak nuclear force, aspects of the electromagnetic force, and so forth. I have my own feeling is that it's more useful to think about the possibility that gravity was weaker in the early universe. And the reason for that is one of the big puzzles that we didn't discuss in any detail here, but it's quite relevant, is a puzzle of time's arrow. Why does time seem to have an orientation to it? And you might say, well, that's just entropy, right? You know, entropy grows in time, and therefore the arrow of time toward the future is in the direction of increasing entropy. But there's a big assumption there. And that assumption is that the entropy in the past was lower, and in particular that the entropy of the Big Bang was the lowest it could possibly have been in this trajectory. And that sets up a tension with gravity, because gravity likes to cause things to clump together. And the early universe, if it was a clumpy configuration, say, of black holes, it would not have had the low entropy necessary for the explanation of time's arrow to work. However, what if gravity was really weak in the early universe? Maybe even gravity pretty much disappeared in the early universe. Then this idea of having clumpy structures, which would ruin the necessity of having a low entropy starting point, that wouldn't be an issue. No gravity, things won't clump. And so I've investigated that idea. It's hard to make any of these ideas fully work, unfortunately. Every time you think you've got it, you realize that there's some hidden assumption that has to do with something that undermines your explanation of time's hour. No one's fully resolved this issue. But weak gravity in the early universe, as opposed to strong gravity in the early universe, is the one that captures my interest.
This has been fun. Thank you for putting up with all this. And hopefully I see you around the neighborhood sometime soon.
Absolutely. Now, thank you, Dennis, for doing this. Enjoyed the questions and the conversation. And hopefully we get some semblance of perhaps the way the world was. And I would definitely enjoy, as we do every 6 months or a year, run into you on Broadway as you're coming back from a run or buying bagels at Nussbaum's or something like that.
All right. Have a nice Great. Evening.
Okay. Thank you. Thanks, everybody else.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.